Okay, so like I just said, we're going to start by a little bit of review because we introduced the verb last week, but we only talked about the real basic components. But we have arrived at that point in the semester where we are just jumping into verbs to where we've really covered every other major part of speech. Verb is the most complex, and so we're going to spend the most time with it. There's the most stuff to know about verbs. And verbs, just like any other language, it's the same in Greek. Verbs are the most important part of any language. They're typically the most complex part of any language. And in Greek, you have five parts to every verb: tense, voice, mood, person, number. We'll talk about those a little bit more detail this evening, help you break that down. But tense, voice, mood, person, and number. And when you parse a verb, that's when you look at a verb and you're trying to figure out basically six things, those five things plus the root. In other words, what's the root of the verb? And so like with your sheet, your master sheet that I think you all should have a copy. If not, I have extras. But that master sheet that I gave you is going to use the Greek verb luo for most of it. But then on the backside with some of your aorists, you'll also have lipo, and I think those are the two verbs. Lipo, luo, oh, and grapho for your second aorist. But so like luo would be your root, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But when you parse a verb, you're basically trying to discern what tense is it in, what voice, what mood, what person, what number, and then the root of the verb, or what's the basic core that all the other stuff is building off of. So when we look at these five things, let me just spend the time explaining those. When we look at tense, there are six tenses in the Greek language. And this is where there's kind of a debate, and we'll talk about it in a second. But there are six tenses. You have the present tense, future tense, aorist tense, imperfect tense, perfect tense, and pluperfect tense. Now, we're not going to spend a lot of time on the pluperfect because it's very rare. It doesn't occur very often in the Greek New Testament. But these tenses, I'll introduce you to the debate here in just a second. There's been a lot of debate on how best to interpret them and how are they being used or how are they functioning in a sentence. The classic way is to basically view them as time-related. And there definitely is some time aspect built in. Well, there is a element of time built into it. But modern debates are largely around the idea of aspect, if you're familiar with that term, where it's like either a completed aspect or an ongoing aspect. So that's kind of more second year stuff, but we'll deal with it a little bit. I'll introduce you to some of that tonight. But typically, when you're learning Greek, they just teach you to think of it in relation to time first, because that's kind of the traditional way of understanding it. And then they get into the more nuanced discourse features and things like that, which we'll, again, talk about a little bit more in a moment. But present is kind of like our present tense. So if you have, let me actually skip to another slide where I talk about this. Okay, so like present tense refers to actions occurring in the present or to actions that are habitual. So on your master sheet, I didn't put numbers on the pages. So it's the one that says noun review program on the front, or, kind of the top left of that sheet. That side of the paper, if you look at the right-hand side, second kind of section down, the conjugation of luo, notice the present active indicative. When you see a present active indicative verb, you translate it, I am loosing. Do you see that underneath the box? It gives you like the asterisk and then how you would translate it. I am loosing. So that's the idea of a present tense, is it's an action occurring at that moment, in the present. And you normally translate it with an ing, not always, because, in English you can say looses, like he looses, or I am loosing, in the first person, I am loosing. That would be a present active indicative. So present is referring to present action. Future, just like our English future, refers to actions that will occur in the future. They haven't happened yet. I will drive home after this class. I'm not driving home because it's not a current action. It's a future action. I will drive home after the class. Aorist tense refers to actions that are in the past without specifying whether it was going on or completed. So an aorist is kind of your simple past tense in Greek. And that's where, you might say, I ate lunch, a couple hours ago. Or on your sheet, it would be I loosed. Your aorist active indicative, I loosed. It's just a simple past tense. But contrast that with the imperfect tense, which refers to actions that were going on in the past. So typically, again, if you have your sheet, it would actually be on the back side of that sheet, I think. Where is the imperfect? It's on here somewhere. You don't have, here, take that one. Yeah. So imperfect would be I was loosing. So it's still a past idea, but it's an action that was ongoing in the past. I say this is the master sheet, but I don't even know if it has imperfect on here.
There's some of the bottom.
Oh, there it is. Okay. Yep, you're right. Very bottom. The bottom two boxes. So that would say, you would translate I was loosing would be your imperfect active indicative. So it's referring to an action that was ongoing in the past. But that's different than the perfect tense. Perfect tense refers to actions that were completed in the past, yet have results or benefits that continue to the present. So if you look at a perfect, you would typically translate that, I have loosed. So it's like you're referring to something that was a past action, but there is a present result associated with it. So I have loose refers this idea that, I loose something in the past, right? But it's still loose right now, right? So you would use the perfect tense, I have loosed. And then the pluperfect is just kind of it refers to actions that were completed in the past, but whose benefits were terminated by another past action. So that's typically translated, I had loosed. Referring to a past action, but it's not necessarily a present benefit. So these are very, and again, feel free to ask questions, but these are very nuanced tenses in the Greek. This is where Greek verb tense is one of the ways that Greek becomes way more complex than it does in English. In English, we typically only have three tenses, right? Past, present, future. That's pretty much it. We do express like a perfect idea or a pluperfect idea or an imperfect idea, but that's where we use other words like I was loosing, I have loosed, I had loosed. It's referring to different aspects of past action. So we kind of do the same thing in English. We just, we use other words to kind of pile up next to verbs to communicate these same ideas. But in Greek, you actually have a different form of the verb that tells you what tense it is. And so it's kind of cool. It's very nuanced. It's very specific, but it's also very complicated because you got now a bunch of forms you're trying to learn. So this is kind of your traditional way of viewing indicative verb tenses is largely with time. It's an aspect of time, past, present, or future. And if it's in the past, was it ongoing action, imperfect? Was it a completed action that has present results, perfect? Or was it a past action that whose benefits were terminated by another past action? So it's totally in the past. That would be a pluperfect. So it takes you a little bit of time to just start wrapping your mind around the different tenses in Greek. But that's normally where we begin the discussion. So back to, here we go. So let's just kind of go back to the major parts of the verb. So there's six tenses: present, future, aorist, imperfect, perfect, or pluperfect. The pluperfect is the most rare form. We don't see that very often in the New Testament, so we won't spend a lot of time with the pluperfect. But then there are three, other than tense of the verb, you also have a voice. There are three voices in the verb, which are active, passive, or middle. Remember us talking about this last week? Active is when you as the subject or the subject is actively doing the action. So I
threw the ball.
Exactly. Subject is the one doing the action. And notice in the voices, and I give you the breakdown here, I get this from Greek Wallace, I think, Dan Wallace, his book, Greek Basics or Beyond the Basics. But he argues that he does a count, and there are 20,697 active verbs, or verbs in the active voice, in the New Testament. So that's by far your most frequent. And then your passive and your middle are almost equally divided. Your passive is 3,933 times. Your middle voice is 3,500 times. And we'll talk about that as you learn your forms, but that's a little bit subjective because the middle and passive is actually the same form most of the time, other than aorist and future. Future and aorist will distinguish. They'll have different forms for the middle than they will for the passive. Most of the time, though, your middle passive is the same form. And so you have to decide in context whether it's a middle voice or a passive voice. But an active voice, again, let's just review the voices. Active voice is I threw the ball. Passive voice is the ball was thrown. Okay, the ball is receiving the action, not doing the action. So they're a passive recipient of the action. Does that make sense?
The ball was thrown at them, so the ball was thrown at me.
Okay. Yeah, to me would be like an indirect object.
So instead of the subject doing it, it receives the action?
Correct, the subject receives the action.
So the subject becomes a
direct. Yeah, in a sense, yeah.
In the passive,
yep. You'll see as we do more reading how sometimes the subject is explicit, sometimes it's implied. But the verb form, if it's passive, then you have to translate it as them receiving the action. So back to your master sheet. Notice the present active indicative, that's translated, I am loosing. But the middle passive, and notice present middle passive is the same form. So it's context that helps you determine whether it's a middle voice or a passive voice. But if it's middle, you say, I am loosing for myself. It's reflexive, exactly. To where in the middle voice, the subject is both doing and receiving the action. So we in English normally translate that with a reflexive. But the idea is you would say like, I fed myself is a, you know, an example of that in English. I fed myself. Where I am the one doing the action, like I'm bringing the fork to my face, right? But I'm also the one receiving the action. I'm eating the food. So I fed myself would be in the middle voice. But in the passive voice, how would I say it in the passive voice? I was fed. Where I'm not doing the action, I'm receiving the action. Right? So like if I have a little child, I fed the baby. Right? So I'm doing the feeding and the baby's receiving. But if you put it from the perspective of the child was fed. All right, so they weren't really doing it. They were receiving the action. So that's the idea of a passive voice. Does that make sense? And then the middle voice is, again, that's where you have, you're doing it, but you're also receiving the action. So there's lots of cool examples of that as we work our way through the New Testament. But your most frequent voice is active, then followed by passive, and then middle. Middle is the least common. But according to Wallace's count, he says it's almost half and half. Or I mean, not half and half, but almost equal. Yeah, between the passive and middle. But normally they teach you that when you see a middle passive form, think passive first. just because that's the more frequent use, but then determine in the context if the middle actually makes more sense. Most of the time, it's obvious in the context, but there's times where it's not obvious, and there's major theological debates that go on whether it's a middle or a passive voice, because it could be either one, which is always fun, right? And the one I always point to is the Romans 9, is it verse 22, where it refers to, are you familiar with that one? Let's go to it real quick. So I got to go to my Greek. So it's Romans 9:22, I think. Oops. There we go. So in Romans 9:22, in English, boy,
you probably can't see that very well. Let me zoom in.
So in English, it's what if God, over here, wanting to show his wrath to make his power known, endured with much long-suffering the vessels of wrath, prepared for destruction. That word that I have boxed out there, prepared, is this word right here in Greek. And that is a middle passive form. So this is a classic debate, right, in Calvinism, is which one is it? If it's a passive, then the vessel of wrath is being prepared for destruction by, assumedly, God would be the subject there, right? That God, wanting to show his wrath to make his power known, endured much long-suffering, the vessels of wrath, prepared for destruction. In other words, the vessel received the action of being prepared for destruction, and God was the one doing it. Does that make sense? However, it's a middle passive form. So if it's middle, then how would you translate that if it's a middle? Exactly. Vessels of wrath preparing themselves for destruction. Does that make sense? So it's a huge difference. Yeah. And so that's where this is a classic place to go. There's several other examples, but this is a classic place to go in the Calvinist Arminian debate is how do you take that verb? Is it a middle or is it a passive? And the grammar won't answer that question for you because it's either one. It can be both. Right? So you have to use context, other passages, right? So that's so exactly. You have to wrestle through that, which is why that's such a debate, right? One of many reasons why it's such a debate, but is because the grammar doesn't necessarily solve it for you.
Even Peter said, many of Paul's teachings are hard.
Yeah. Well said. Exactly. But this is just I like coming here just to show you the illustration is if middle or a passive, it totally changes the way you read that verse, right? But that's where middle passives can become rather fun to study, kind of interesting. But do you understand the difference between a middle or a passive voice? Okay, and an active voice? Okay, so then let's go back to the verb here. So there's six tenses, present, future, aorist, imperfect, perfect, or blue perfect. Three voices, active, passive, middle. But there are also four moods, we call them. A mood, you have indicative, subjunctive, optative, imperative. So indicative is what you consider, it's the mood of, they typically call it the mood of reality or factuality. But don't care that too far because lies are normally told in the indicative. Okay, so it doesn't necessarily mean. Yeah, exactly. It's your own reality. Yeah. So indicative, you're just stating it like a fact. Like, I am here. Okay? You're just stating a fact. Different than subjunctive. Subjunctive is you're stating a probability, a potentiality. So like we were, last week or 2 weeks ago, we were translating John 3:16. Right? So let's go back to that just real quick. And just remember which verb is in the subjunctive. So in John 3:16... right? This is just the verse that we keep coming back to because everybody's familiar with it. I got to get out of this quick. Now you can see it. Okay, so in John 3:16, for God so loved the world, right? So here's your Greek. Hutos, gar, thus or in this way, or so would be hutos. Gar is your post-positive for. You translate it for, or because. But for, but post-positive meaning it comes second word in the sentence in Greek, but in English you would put it first in your translation. So for, thus, or in this way, God, there's your subject. How do we know that's the subject?
That has the article.
Good. So it's article in what case?
The nominative.
Good. So your nominative case is normally functioning as the subject of your sentence, but it can also be a predicate adjective. But yes, here it's clearly the subject. So for thus, or in this way, God, and then this is the word agape, not that you'd recognize it, but okay, because it is agapesen. And you're going to learn this, right, as you master your indicative verb chart. Then, I mean, does anyone know offhand? What tense is that in? Agapesen. Good. So it's aorist. Yep. So God loved. And so but it's first person singular. So I'm sorry. Did I say first person? Mm-hmm. Third person singular. God loved. And we'll talk about how you figure out that that's an aorist, you know, as we go. But basically it's from agapao would be the lexical form, the root form, agapao. But it's spelled with an alpha on the front, not an eta. So what you have there is, it's called an augment. It's a prefix that is put on the front of it that tells you, if you see a prefix, you automatically think, oh, it's either aorist or imperfect. And this one also has a sigma. So you have an alpha, it normally begins with an alpha up here, the agapao, but because you have an eta, the epsilon and alpha amalgamate and they become an eta. And so you see a prefix, but then it's agape sen. The sigma there is a giveaway for the aorist. And so you'll learn all that in due time. We'll hopefully jump into some of that tonight. But once you learn your forms, you're like, okay, that's an aorist. For God so loved, or in this way, thus God loved, and then ton kosmon. Remember that? That is, how do you remember your vocab? Or you just quote John 3:16 and you know what it says. Ton kosmon, God so loved the world. Okay, but that's in what case? Ton kosmon with the end, the new on the end. It's functioning as the direct object. Excellent. What's the name of the case? You remember? Good. Accusative. So it's in the accusative. So that tells you it's not the world loved God, right? That would not be good. That's not a good translation because God is the subject. It's God loved the world. And it tells you that by what case it's in, right? So God, ha theos, agapesen, ton kosmon. So God that loved the world so that the Son, ton monogene, so the one and only Son, or the only begotten Son, but remember all the scholars now, not all, it's still hotly debated, but most of your modern scholars are coming to a consensus that monogene is better translated unique or only. Yeah, one of a kind, not only begotten. So that the only begotten Son, and then here's our, it's another aorist active indicative, he gave. It's from Didomi. So that the only begotten Son he gave. But notice, it's not, so the subject there is inherent in the verb. You notice that? It says, God loved the world so that the Son, the one and only Son, he gave. So notice the ton huion ton monogene, the one and only Son, that is, it's in what case? Again, it's accusative again. So it's referring, it's a direct object in the sentence. All right. So I don't know if this is being super distracting. We can come here. There we go. Get rid of all that blue stuff. Those are other markers that we'll talk about later. It's discourse features, but at this moment, it's distracting. So, where was I? Hosta tan huian autu tan monogane edokin. So he gave his only begotten son, or the one and only unique son, his only unique one-of-a-kind son, in order that, now this is, again, we'll learn this, but, well, I'm trying to, by repetition, teach you, but hina is most often, yep, indicating a subjunctive is coming next. The next major verb is going to be a subjunctive. Because it's typically, you translate hina, what?
So that.
Yep, that, in order that, so that. In this case, it's a purpose clause, so hina plus the subjunctive. So, in order that, all, pas, and then this is actually a substantive participle, remember, we haven't learned this yet, but I think we talked about it, is pistuon is a participle, so it's technically believing, believing, but then ha pistuon is the one believing, the believing one. So all or everyone who believes in him, and then here's our subjunctive, may not perish, but may have eternal life. So the subjunctive is not a statement of fact, it's a statement of potentiality. So notice in this text you have two indicatives, God loved the world, and he gave his son. That's history. It's fact. It's past events. He loved the world. He gave his son. But the potential is that whoever believes in him, to everyone who believes, the believing one, the one who believes in him, may not perish but have everlasting life. In other words, that is a potentiality. You not perishing but having eternal life is not a guarantee. Rather, it is something that happens only if you believe.
It's a provision.
Exactly. It's a provision to the one who believes. And so the idea is that it's not spoken in the indicative. It's rather placed in the subjunctive because it's saying, well, it's potential. You can avoid being, you know, perishing, and you can have eternal life, but it's contingent upon belief. Did you have, yeah?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because it's like you may have eternal life. Kind of like when you ask your mother if you can have a cookie, you say, may I have a cookie?
Yeah, in a sense, when you ask that, you're in polite English, it's just a polite request, but it does have a subjunctive sense to it, is you're asking for it, but you don't know if you're going to get one or not, right? Which, yeah, that's kind of a subjunctive idea. So subjunctive is the concept of, again, I think, that's on your master sheet as well, on the backside. So notice on the backside, your present active subjunctive, it's your third box down on the top right hand, or top left hand, sorry. Your third box down, present active subjunctive is, notice how you would translate that. I may be loosing. Do you see that? I may be loosing, or might be loosing. So it's talking about potentiality. Well, let me somewhat amend that, because people will often, we don't see a lot of optative in the New Testament, but back to your four moods, you have indicative, subjunctive, optative, and imperative. Subjunctive is typically your mood of potentiality, or better, probability. It's likely going to happen, right? But it hasn't happened yet. Optative is a little weaker than that. It's more like your I wish, I hope, if that makes sense. And so it's similar to subjunctive, but it's less forceful. It doesn't show up a lot in the New Testament. I don't remember the exact count, but there's not a lot of optative verbs in the New Testament, so you're not going to run into it very often. But when you do, then recognize that it's like a subjunctive, but weaker. It's more wishful, hopeful, less likely. So that's where subjunctive is typically considered like probability. It will probably happen versus optative being potentiality. Like it potential to happen.
Does Paul use that when he wishes everybody could speak in tongues? Does he use that? I
don't know offhand.
That comes out all the time. He wishes that for people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know
That's a good question.
Yeah, because he just
I don't know.
Before that, he asked the question, does everybody speak in tongues? But he asked it in the way that you have to answer no.
Right. Yeah, you remember? We looked at that with negatives.
Yeah.
That's right. So he actually is asking the question, implying a negative answer. Not everyone speaks in tongues, do they? Right? That's how he states it in the Greek.
So he says, if I have my brothers, I would have you all. But that's not God's brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Where does he say that? It's 1 Corinthians 12? Where does he say that? I want you.
This is where Elisa introduced us to the pirate Greek.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Let's see. I have to look that up. So quote it again. How does he say it?
Corinthians 14:5.
Oh, is it 14:5? Well, there we go. I wish. Oh, no. That's just present active indicative. I wish, I desire, but it's built into the word thelo.
So he's just stating it.
Yeah, he's just stating. It's in the indicative, though.
So there's no potential there. It's just...
Yeah, he's just, I wish you all spoke in tongues, but even more that you prophesy. But prophesy, yeah, prophesy is actually in the subjunctive. So he says, I desire... that all you to speak, there's your infinitive, to speak in tongues or with tongues, but rather or more so that in order that, and there's your subjunctive, you may prophesy.
So it's like a parent saying, I wish you all minded me.
Yeah, yeah, kind of.
Knowing it's not going to happen.
Yeah, there you go. But that's also a normal way of expressing purpose. Or in this case, it's actually kind of a completer. It's a complementary verb. I wish that you speak in tongues, but more that you may prophesy. So it's connected to the wish. I wish that you might prophesy, but I wish it more than you would speak in tongues. But yeah, but he actually places that in the subjunctive. Mm-hmm.
Is that because they actually do have the potential to prophesy versus we don't all have the potential to speak in tongues, but everyone has the possibility of speaking in prophecy?
Well, in prophecy, proclaiming God's word. Is that teaching or is that the word
that's used here? Yeah, I mean, I think it's that's a debate. Yeah. I mean, what is he saying here? Is it prophecy, like in the sense of a supernatural, or in the teaching? And I think his main point as he works his way through is edification. So he's like, in other words, I think it's either one, right? I mean, take your pick. But if whether you're prophesying supernaturally or prophesying in the sense of teaching, the idea is that you're speaking clearly in an understandable language that they can then be edified by it.
The results in edification.
Right. But just speaking in tongues without translating or interpreting.
No reason.
Yeah, he's like, people are not, yeah, they're not edified.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Nice rabbit hole.
Yes, oh boy. Yes.
We have a minute to look at it. It's interesting.
Absolutely. And, I mean, and we're just... Again, doing a real cursory, we could do a deep dive on that and have a lot of fun. But, and we'll do that more and more, you know, as we get more advanced in our reading skills. But for now, just understand indicative is typically called the mood of reality. Subjunctive, potentiality, or probability is probably a better word. But then optative is more your potentiality. But we don't come across a lot of those in the New Testament. I should look that up. Maybe I'll try and remember to look that up for you next week. But optative, there's not a lot of them in the New Testament. But then your fourth and final mood is your imperative. And that's the command, right? And you're commanding someone to do something. And so imperative is just like the way it is in English, right? So just you're issuing a command. Now, we'll talk about when we get to imperatives, there's a lot of different types of commands. And the imperative in Greek is kind of cool. Like, you can actually use it a bunch of different ways. You, in other words, you're either commanding someone to stop doing something they're currently doing, or you can do a general prohibition. Don't ever do that. There can be, you can order them to stop doing something, but just for now. Like, not necessarily a total prohibition. Like, you can maybe do it later, but not right now. So there's a lot of subtleties in the imperative that you normally don't see brought across very well in English, because there's not, like, in English we just have a basic command, unless we add a bunch of other words. But in the structure of the Greek, they can basically, if it's in the present or the aorist tense, and what there's some other, you know, like what voice it's in, active, passive. There you can, we'll talk about it when we get there, but you can nuance what kind of command you're giving. So again, back to the big picture. Verbs, you have 6 tenses, 3 voices, 4 moods, but then you also have 3 persons. And 3 persons, just like in English, first person is I or we. We would just be plural, I would be singular. Second person, you or y'all, you all. Third person, he or them. You're talking about a third party, someone not present. He or them. So I, first person, you, second person, he, third person. Or if you put it in the plural, it's we, y'all, them. They or them. So that's pretty similar to English. Not much to say there. Other than, then you have the 2 numbers. So you have 3 persons and 2 numbers. 2 numbers just being singular or plural. Right? So like I is singular, we is plural. You is singular, you all, y'all is plural. He, singular, they, them, plural. So again, when you parse a verb, you basically are trying to identify the 5 major parts of the verb plus the root. So like if you were to take a, you know, Greek exam, and on that you have to take, you know, you have to parse these 5 verbs or whatever, then you actually are supposed to give 6 different things. You would give tense, voice, mood, person, number, and the root that it comes from. And it's the same thing in Hebrew. When you do it in Hebrew, they're the same thing. They're just trying to get you to identify the different parts of the verb plus the root so that you know which root it's coming from. That's even more important in Hebrew because it's more obvious in Greek. In Hebrew, it's harder because it can radically change the spelling. And that happens in Greek too, but less frequently, where the root actually radically changes, the spelling changes. So sometimes you mistranslate a word because it looks like another word, right? Because it's changed enough in its spelling that you misidentify the root of the word. And so you...
Doesn't Hebrew kind of take spelling as a fluid thing?
Yeah, yes, yeah. Well, specifically names.
Yes.
Yeah, in names, it's hilarious.
In the same verse, sometimes it can...
Yeah, my favorite is in like, I think it's... I can't remember which chapter it is, but in Daniel, the name Nebuchadnezzar shows up 3 times in the same chapter, and every time it's spelled different, right? Because you're just kind of getting an approximation, right? Just kind of throw the letters in there to where they get the sound about right, and you move on. But that also was, you know, a Babylonian name that they were transliterating into Hebrew. So like the spelling is all over the place. It's kind of funny, but so while it is possible to memorize hundreds of Greek verb forms through brute strength, it's more efficient to learn how verbs are built from the root up and then be able to deconstruct the verb in order to find its most basic parts. So that's the way I'm going to teach you to do it. It's the way I was taught how to do it all the way back in high school. And they still taught me that in college, but my high school prof was really a master at this. He helped me understand verbs to the point that you can reduce it to its most basic parts, and it's easier to begin to identify them. So that's the way I'm going to teach you. The way we're going to approach it is we're going to try to first tackle indicative verbs, because by far that's the most frequent verb in the New Testament. 15,628 verbs are in the indicative mood. Second most frequent is, I do have it written down. There we go. Optative is 68 times. So that's why it's very rare. The optative does not appear that often, 68 times. Subjunctive is going to appear 1,858 times, imperative 1,632 times, optative, which we're not really even going to talk about because you're not going to, other than just you're aware of it, it's a thing, but you're not going to come across it very often. But then infinitives, more frequent because you're 2,291 times, and then participles, 1,799 times. So that's the order in which we're going to study the verbs. We're going to start with the indicative because that's kind of the master chart. If you can learn the indicative chart, all the other ones come easier because it's basically they're just changing a couple subtleties and they're easier to identify. So we're going to start with kind of the big one, the indicative verbs, then subjunctive, then imperative. We'll just, again, not really talk about the optative a whole lot. But then we're saving infinitives and participles for last because they function similarly in sentences, infinitives and participles. But then participles they're fun. There's a ton of ways you can use a participle. The participle uses are very complex. But there's a lot of cool things you can do with participles in Greek. So we'll kind of save that for last. So let's go back for a few minutes. Well, first, questions so far on just the major parts of a verb, five major parts, and then you have your sixth, you know, as if you're parsing it, you're looking for also the root of the verb. But I'm going to come back to a discussion on tenses. That's what I'm going to do next. But can you generally understand those five major parts of every verb, tense, voice, mood, person, number? Do you understand what those are communicating? Okay. All right, so pretty straightforward there. So let's go back to the tense discussion just quickly because there's a lot that we, again, can talk about. So like I said, the traditional view to, and this is, again, it's worth learning because this is what is your most, you're going to come across it in most Greek grammars. When you translate, you have to kind of know what tense to put it in English. And so your tenses are very much oriented to time, but there's a lot more going on than just a simple time marker. So you have your present tense, present action, future tense, future action. Aorist is your simple past. That is all pretty much familiar to us in English because that's what we basically have in English is past, present, future, right? We understand that. We think that way. No big deal. Nothing new to learn. But it gets more complex with these three, imperfect, perfect, pluperfect. Is in Greek, you have these three additional tenses that are all still technically in the past, but they're referring to different types of actions in the past. Imperfect is an ongoing action that occurred in the past. I was loosing. Perfect tense refers to actions that were completed in the past, yet have results or benefits continuing to the present. I have loosed in your Luo chart. Luo would be I loose. Your imperfect form, I was loosing. Perfect form, I have loosed. Pluperfect, I had loosed. Refers to actions that were complete in the past and whose benefits were terminated by another past action. Again, pluperfect does not show up that often. Again, I don't have the numbers for that. But you're not going to run across that very often. It's only a handful of times that you have a pluperfect verb form in the Greek New Testament. But you will encounter a lot of imperfect forms, particularly in narrative, and perfect forms. They're less frequent than, you know, your active forms, or your present active. But they're still frequent enough that you need to learn those forms pretty well. But there's another whole dynamic that's called, rather than time, they talk about verbal aspect. Have you dove into aspect much?
A little bit.
So aspect is basically, and this is actually really helpful if you've studied Hebrew, because in Hebrew, Hebrew's verb is a little simpler. There's fewer tenses in Hebrew than there are in Greek. But you basically have two big aspects, completed or ongoing aspect. Completed means, and that's just you're viewing the action as a completed action. It's typically used for the past tense, but you're viewing the action as a whole. Whereas if you're an ongoing aspect or an imperfect, sometimes they call it perfect, imperfect, which I know that gets confusing because there's a perfect and imperfect tense, but that's different than aspect. They talk about a perfect or a completed aspect versus imperfect would be an imperfect is an incompleted aspect. So, for instance, in narrative, you normally see past tense verbs. So like, for instance, if you're reading narrative, so Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, most of your narrative in the New Testament is the default tense in the narrative is aorist tense. We do the same thing in English. When we tell a story, we normally put it in the past tense and we just say one thing after the next, right? We all drove here, we walked in, we sat down, we started Greek. Okay, we just told a simple little narrative, but we put it all in the past tense. That's normal. That's your default. And this is where tense can get really interesting. In modern studies, they start talking more about aspect and then the discourse dynamics of what tense is being used. We're going to start dabbling in this more when we do our, you know, John reading. But aorist is your default tense in narrative. Thus, it's unmarked, they call it. In other words, that's the one that you should assume is going to be there. So when you see an aorist in narrative, there's nothing special about it. It's just your normal default tense that is used in narrative. And so you're expecting to see an aorist. So when you see an aorist, it's normal. And so you shouldn't make a big deal out of it. Present tense, however, is your default tense in the epistles or dialogue. Because when you're speaking with someone in that present moment, or you're talking to them or telling them something, particularly in an epistle where Paul is commanding them to do something, it's normally in the present tense because he's talking to them at that moment, trying to help them understand something. So present tense is normally, that's considered your unmarked or your normal default tense in epistles or dialogue, meaning like in a narrative, in the Gospel of John, for instance, if it goes to discourse where Jesus is teaching a crowd, direct discourse, that's normally going to be present tense. So when you see a difference, so like when we are reading narrative and you're expecting an aorist tense, but you see a present tense, that should catch your attention. In fact, it's called a historic present is the way they often describe it in Greek grammars. But the idea is that it's slowing down the story and it's trying to make you part of the action. It's typically used to catch your attention because you're normally like thinking past tense. But when it uses a present tense, it's slowing down the narrative. It's trying to catch your attention. It's drawing you into the story. So let's go back to what I just said. You know, if we are normally telling a story, we say, it's just reporting what we did here. We drove here, walked in the door, sat down, and we began, you know, started Greek. But if we put that same sequence of actions in the present tense, then it's like we're drawing you into the story a little bit. I'm driving to the church. I'm walking in the door. I'm sitting down, and then we're starting Greek. All right? So it's like it's describing the actions as if you were right there next to him. Right? It's kind of drawing you in. It's using a present tense, an ongoing or imperfect aspect is what they call it, where it's like it's the action's not over yet. I'm walking in the door. Rather than if I say, well, I walked in the door. Like I'm viewing it as, well, it's over. Like, you know, the action's complete. We're done walking. We're now sitting.
And now everybody else is late.
Exactly. Exactly. So your aorist tense is just your simple completed, or sometimes they call it perfected action, but it's just a completed action that you just say, we walked, we sat, we started. But when you put it in the present tense or an imperfect action or an imperfect aspect, they call it an ongoing aspect, then you're watching that action as it's unfolding. All right? I don't know. So this is an illustration they often use. I think it breaks down at some points. But to try and help you understand the difference between like an aorist versus a present tense, it's often used the illustration of watching a parade. Okay? So think about watching a parade. But if you were up in a blimp, or a hot air balloon, or high on a tower, and you could see the entire parade at one glance, right? You see the beginning and the end all at once. That's like an aorist tense. You're seeing the entire parade in one snapshot, and you're seeing the complete thing. But that's different perspective if you were down on the street. If you're down on the street watching the parade go by, you can't see the beginning of it. You can't see the ending of it. You're right in the middle, and all you can see is right what's right in front of you as it's walking by. That's more your present tense. Does that make sense? You're in the middle of it. You're watching the action unfold, but you didn't see it start, and you don't see the end. You're watching it as it's unfolding. That's your present perspective. And that's where it's a little, that's kind of the difference between, like, in aspect, a verb that is viewed as a complete whole versus a verb that is incomplete. It's unfolding. It hasn't completed itself yet. It's still going on. It's unfolding as you watch. So again, we'll get more into this. This will make more sense the more we read and see how this is used in the different texts. But for now, just understand the aspect of completed versus incomplete action. But let me introduce just a couple more things about tense. So aorist, default tense in narrative. So back to the notes. Narrative is default tense in narrative. Aorist, I'm sorry, is your default tense in narrative. Present tense is your default tense in epistles and dialogue. Your future tense is just like English describing a future action. There's not much difference between an English and a Greek future tense. It's pretty much the same. There's a couple places where future tense, and they get this from the Septuagint, but they will issue a command in the future tense because they did that a lot in the translation of the Septuagint. In the Greek, translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. So they drug that into English. And you see it mostly in the New Testament. You see it in the New Testament when a New Testament is quoting an Old Testament text. So like the Ten Commandments, thou shalt have no God before me, or, thou don't make a graven image, or whatever the command is. In Greek, they normally would say that in the future with a negative. You will not have a God before me. You will not have, whatever. You will not steal. And so that's another way the future tense is used. Is that it can talk about a future action, or it can be used in a prohibition where you're commanding something never to be done. But then you have imperfect and perfect. This is really, I'm just introducing this to you because it's interesting, but this is really definitely second year stuff. Like, this is second year Greek stuff. But imperfect and perfect tenses are really cool in how they appear in narrative. Because an imperfect tense is normally used to background an action within a narrative, making the action less prominent than the primary tense, which is your primary tenses are going to be present, aorist, or future tense. An imperfect tense is like it's a secondary tense. It's less frequent, and it's typically giving you background information. And yet the information is important. It's needed to understand the main verb, but it's less prominent than the main verb. So a couple examples of this. Let's go to, real quick, let's just, for sake of time, let's go to the second one, Mark 4:38. So Mark 4:38, go there real quick. And notice, let me just show you how this works in a narrative. We're going to spend a lot more time when we start reading, the Gospel of John together. We're going to start trying to draw attention to this more often. But it makes narratives a lot of fun to study in Greek, is because of the verbal aspect that's associated with the different tenses. And it helps you understand what the author saw as most important or what he wanted to make prominent. So notice, if we're to read Mark 4:38 in English, it says, "But he, Jesus, was in the stern, asleep on a pillow, and they awoke him and said to him, 'Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?'" So notice this in Greek. In Greek, it's kai, ein, autos, and you don't know this yet, but ein is the imperfect active indicative of eimi. So you would just translate that was. He was epi te prumne, in the stern, epiton, I love this word, proskephalion. Proskephalion. You know what that word is?
Cushion.
It's cushion. But break it down. It's actually a compound word. Toward. Yep, pros, to or toward. You know what it is? Yes. So kephalion is kephale is the word that just means head. It's just your vocab word that means head. So cushion is literally the word your head towards it. Okay, it's that thing you put your head on. Okay, I mean, it's like, okay, right? I mean, it's just in Greek, that's the way they said it, right? That so it's the word kind of defines itself. Okay, but so he was, in perfect tense, he was in the stern upon a pillow and then sleeping. This is actually a participle, which is not the main verb, right? Participles are always subordinate to the main verb. We'll talk about that when we get to participles. But that is all background information. In order to make sense of the scene, you need to know that he was in the stern, asleep, on a pillow is just kind of a nice little, you know, eyewitness detail they throw in. But he's sleeping in the back of the boat on a pillow. That's background information. Then it says, and Kai, here's Kai. And then here's our big word. And this is your present active indicative, third person plural, they awoke him, or they stirred him to action. They aroused him from his sleep. And this is present tense, which is interesting because in normal narrative, what are we expecting? We're expecting an aorist, right? So just a normal, simple past tense. They woke him up. But this is, again, it's present. So it's not what you'd expect. It's drawing you into the story. It's slowing you down. It's drawing our attention to this action that they, it's like, okay, he was in the back of the boat, asleep on a pillow, and then they start shaking him, right? So it's like this idea is a present tense verb. They awake him, which is interesting because notice how most English translations will still put that in the past. Like here's the New King James. They awoke him. I'm actually curious how many translations will put that. Here's just a quick, see, King James says awake. They awake him. I like that. Awoke him, New King James. Woke him, ESV. Wake him up, that's the Young's literal, which is he's trying to be as literal as possible. So he does put it in the present. But woke him, past tense in the NET. Woke him, NASB. LSB, that's the Lexham standard. They got him up, but notice it's still past tense. Woke him, LEB. So most of them are going to put it in the past tense, which is normal in translation work. I personally don't do that. I don't like that because I like to know that it's a past or a present tense instead of a past tense, an aorist tense. But it's this is where they call it a historic present, meaning it's a present tense, but they typically teach you to translate it like a past tense because it's in a narrative. It's telling you of an event that happened in the past. So they normally will translate it like a past tense, though it's technically a present tense, which kind of drives me crazy. I don't like that. But that's what you know, most grammars will teach you to do that, and most English translations follow that. So you can't always know if it's a present or an aorist unless you look at the Greek. Because most of your English translations, you can't trust them in that aspect, right? They're not going to tell you, or it could be wrong. And so, because they're following, you know, some grammarian rule that hey, if it's in a narrative, just translate it like a past tense. But when you study it in Greek, it's helpful because it's showing you that it's actually a present tense, and it's breaking the norm. It's normally an aorist tense in narrative. So when it uses a historic present or a present tense in a narrative, then it's slowing down the narrative. It's drawing you in. It's drawing your attention to it. It's violating what you would normally expect to see in order to draw your attention to it. So they wake him, and another present active indicative, they say to him, and then this is, you know, normally, well, without me putting my cursor on it, do you know that word, didaskale? Didaskale?
Teacher.
Good. Teacher.
Teaching.
But put it in context, okay? What case is that in? Kind of a trick question. Because I taught you... No. So capitalized because it's like the beginning of a direct discourse. It's a quotation. So it is capitalized. That's good. But I taught you primarily four cases. And I said there is technically a fifth case, but we don't need to worry about it because it's obvious in context. The four cases are, remember, nominative. That's the naming case, typically the subject of the sentence. Genitive, your descriptive case normally, or possessive. Dative, that would be normally your indirect object or instrument means, and then accusative. Okay, that's the four cases. I said those are the ones you really need to memorize. But do you remember the fifth case? I said don't worry about it. Exactly. So that's what is here.
We should have been worried.
Yeah, that's right.
Stop worrying.
That's right. Don't worry about it. So I said, don't worry about memorizing the form because it's obvious in context. It's technically called the vocative case. And vocative is the case of direct address. It's when you address someone that's right in front of you. And I say, Eric, you know, give me a cup of coffee or something. You know, that would be vocative, Eric, and then probably an imperative, like, give me a cup of coffee. I don't want a cup of coffee. But the point is, that's direct address, vocative. Well, notice it's pretty obvious as you read. Teacher, right? They're addressing him. So that's actually a evocative. So you could burn a lot of brain power trying to memorize all the evocative forms or just know that it's the case of direct address. And so when you see someone, and it's often capitalized, not always, but it's often capitalized because it's addressing someone, and it's often, it's most of the time, this is a title, but it's mostly a name or a title is in the vocative case because you're addressing someone, like Grant, Zoe, or in this case, teacher. They're using it as a title, teacher, but it's in the vocative. So anyways, and then it says, U mele soy hati apalumitha. Do you not care, or is it not a care to you? Because that's the, I think it's interesting. They're actually putting the you, singular dative. Is it not a care to you that we... perishing. We are perishing. Is present tense.
Which that question shows why the background is necessary because they're assuming he doesn't care because he was sleeping.
Exactly. Exactly. So again, if we were to take all these verbs in this, what's the most important verb it's drawing our attention to? Two verbs. They woke him up and they said to him. Like that's what they want. That's really where the narrator is trying to get us to see. They aroused him and they... speak to him, master or teacher, do you not care that we're perishing? That's what they want to draw our attention to is the direct address, what they say to him, that they wake him up and they speak to him. But in order to understand those verbs, you have to understand this background information. Why did they have to arouse him? Because he was sleeping in the back of the boat on a pillow. Right?
Is think that he just didn't care.
Exactly, exactly. Which helps you understand their question. Teacher, do you not care that we, and again, notice that's in the present, we are perishing. We are in the process of perishing, right? We're drowning. The boat is filling up. The water's coming in. The boat's sinking, right? Like we are in the middle of perishing. Why don't you care? And so it's kind of a cool, again, once you understand the verb dynamics, it's kind of fun. You got a thought?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about Jonah.
Okay. Yep.
And then they wake him up as like, pray to your God and stuff. And while the disciples, they literally have God in the boat who's also sleeping. But it's like, instead of the ship people are praying to their gods, they're literally asking God if he's caring to help them.
That's good. That's a pretty dramatic contrast, isn't it?
In Jonah's case, though, it was the case of denial.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, no doubt. No, that's good. Good observation. Way to think intertextually. I like it. So we're going to see a lot more examples of this as we work our way through. In fact, what was my other one? Matthew 19. There we go. Let's just look at this real quick. All right, Matthew 19:21. This one, I actually, I should have probably taken you this one first. Doesn't matter. But the point is, this one's even maybe a better example. So in English, you're familiar with it. It's over here in English. Jesus said to them, if you want to be perfect, go sell what you have, give to the poor. You will have treasure in heaven. Come and follow me. But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. So notice in the Greek, starts with imperfect tense. Jesus said to him, direct address, if, present active indicative, you desire perfect to be, if you want to be perfect, imperative, go, hupage, go, another imperative, sell, poleison, sell what of you the possessions, or what you have, what belongs to you. And das, another imperative, give to the poor. This is a substantive adjective in the dative. So you're giving it to them, right? They're the indirect object of the action. You're giving, that's the verb, direct object, what you own to the poor. What you sold, you give to the poor. And now this is future. You will have treasure in heaven. So future tense, something that, you will have treasure in heaven. Because if you give up all that you have now, you're out of treasures. But don't worry about it. There is future treasure in heaven. And present active, come and follow me. So notice almost all of those are imperatives. You have the introduction line, Jesus says to him, or Jesus was saying to him. So that's just your imperfect tense. That's kind of your backgrounded information. And then his direct speech, if you desire perfect to be, and then it's all imperatives. Go, sell, give, and then future, you will have treasure in heaven. And then he says, come, follow me. But notice this. This is cool. We'll get into this. This is another good example when we get to participles. But akousos, you know that one. What's the root of akousos here?
Akouo.
Good. Akouo. Your vocab words. Akouo, we get the English word. Yeah, we talked about that last week. It was on the quiz. Acoustics, good. But this is the participle form. So hearing and hearing. The young man hearing ton lagon, this word, aorist active indicative, he departs, and then this is your another participle, he departs sorrowful. So notice, out of those three verbal ideas in that first clause, there's only one finite verb. You have two participles and a finite verb. Your two participles are hearing and sorrowing. But what's the key action that the author wants you, what's the main action he wants you to see? He departed. So hearing is, it's kind of your adverbial participle. He departs. Because he heard. Hearing this word, he departs. And then sorrowing is telling you, it's an adverbial participle, kind of telling you how he departs. He departs sorrowful. He's sorrowing as he departs. But I think it's interesting in the narrative, what's the key verb that he wants us to see? He departs. And he departs because that's what condemned him. Is he departs from this, from Jesus after hearing this word. And then notice one more line, for he was having great possessions, or lots of possessions. And notice that's back in the imperfect tense. The was is imperfect. So it helps give you background information as to why he was sorrowful. Why was he sorrowful? Because he had a lot of possessions. And so that's why he departed in sorrow, or sorrowfully. Sorrowing. He departed sorrowing. So anyways, I don't know. Maybe I'm going too deep into this for first-year students, okay? But you're all brilliant first-year students because now you know a bunch of second-year stuff, okay? But when you get into some of the what verbal tense is being used, it's really kind of fun in the narrative because it helps you see what the author wants prominent, the main point he's trying to make, he departed. But then some of the background, you know, information is put in the imperfect tense or in participles, like subordinate verbal ideas are put in the participle form. So hearing, he departs, sorrowing, for he was having great possessions. So it's little subtleties like this as you work your way through and become more prominent, you know, this becomes more, you know, ingrained in your thinking, that it makes reading a narrative in Greek way more fun than reading it in English because it's bringing out nuances that you're not going to see in English. And so it's really kind of fun to draw your attention to some of these things. So I really need to be done talking about tenses, but so your imperfect tense is often backgrounding action within narrative, making the action less prominent than the primary tense. Primary tenses are your present, aorist and your future, but it's giving background information. Your perfect tense signals information that is relevant for the main action to occur. It appears almost evenly between the genres, narrative, epistle, or dialogue. The perfect tense it's actually one of the most grammatically important tenses when you are studying, like doing exegesis, is when you see a perfect tense, it's less frequent, and it's one of the most pronounced of the tenses. It's like almost like he's underlining it or putting an exclamation point by it. The idea is he's drawing your attention to it, and he's giving relevant information that you need to be aware of. So, for instance, in John 20, verse 31, it's the statement at the end of the Gospel of John where he's telling you why he wrote the Gospel. And he says, "But these things were written in order that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God." And the idea is that he puts these things were written in the perfect passive. And the concept is that this is really important, necessary information that you have to have in order that you may believe. And I should double check that, but I think the may believe is probably in the subjunctive. Was that John 20, 31? Yeah, so these things were written. So notice this is a perfect passive. So the things did not write themselves, right? They were written. So it's in the passive. Words were written. These things were written. In other words, what he just put down, which is interesting because rather than saying, "I wrote these things," he puts it in the passive. These things were written. But notice in the perfect tense, it has the idea of, again, past action with a present effect. Right, so a past action, he wrote it in the past, but it has a present effect, it has a present purpose. And then he says, "Hina, that you, in order that you may believe," there's our subjunctive, that you may believe, you might believe, because your belief is not guaranteed. Because how many people read the Gospel of John and they walk away as unbelievers? Right, so reading the Gospel does not guarantee that you become a believer, but it is the purpose for which it was written. These things were written in order that you may believe, what? That Jesus, Hati Iesus, Estin, is Ha Christos, Ha Huios Ton Theou, that Jesus is the Christ, Son of God, and that believing, that's a participle, life you may have. You may have life in his name. So notice in that same verse, you have several different verbs. That's a perfect verb. This is a subjunctive, an aorist subjunctive. Here's your participle down here. And then this is your, again, present active subjunctive here. So you're seeing the different ways tenses are used. These things were written, past action with a present result, but it's relevant information you need to know in order to understand what he says next. These things were written, why? That you may believe, potential, in the subjunctive, that you may believe, Believe what? That Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And that believing, you might have life in his name. So again, you will have life if you, again, he connects it to believing. Believing, you may have life in his name. But he puts it before the verb. It's a participle before the verb. And the idea is that you don't have life until you believe. Believing has to happen first, and then you have life. Believing, you have life in his name. All right? Clear as mud? How's that make it? Is it making sense? Are you tracking with me? Questions on this? Now, we're wading into deep waters here, okay? So, like, there are whole volumes of books written to debate the uses of tenses. And I'm just trying to introduce you to it because it is a pretty deep subject. But I'm trying to help you see at least the lay of the land and some of the, you know, the stuff we're going to be getting into more as we read more. So, but tenses, verbs are very complex, right? There's just a lot of moving parts to verbs. But tense is the most debated part of the verbal system. How is it functioning best, you know, or in the sentence? And
that would follow the context a lot, wouldn't it?
Very much, yeah. Yep. But they're still writing doctoral dissertations on these topics.
Sure.
You know, because like the imperfect tense is now pretty much universally agreed upon in narrative, it's functioning to background information. But there, no one yet has studied or written a doctoral dissertation on what the function of the imperfect tense is in epistles or direct discourse. Because it doesn't appear often in epistles, but when it does, why would the writer use the imperfect tense in that, you know, text? And that's actually an area of Greek study that's kind of cutting edge Greek studies right now, that's one of the things that needs to be figured out. And so a lot of, you know, doctoral students will write in linguistics because there's a lot of issues like that that are not, they haven't been tackled yet. And so if you ever go for your PhD, okay, in linguistics, then write that, write on that, okay? But it's one of those things that and what we're doing is we're just reading the Greek New Testament, but now we're broadening. We're reading a bunch of the other Greek classics. We're reading a lot of other works that were written in Koine Greek. We're trying to find patterns to how they use certain tenses in certain contexts. And the more we learn, the better readers we become of the Greek New Testament. And we get more nuanced. We get sharper. We get better at reading it the more we learn. So anyways, so that's, again, big introduction to verbs. But questions so far on the major parts of the verb, tenses, that's going to make more sense the more we read and you see it in actual verses. And you're like, oh, okay, all right, I'm starting to see the patterns, why they would use a perfect tense, aorist tense, present tense in that context. And then times where it violates your expectation, right? Like, oh, wait, that should be an aorist tense, but it's a present tense. Yeah, he's trying to draw your attention. He's trying to catch your attention and say, hey, this is really important. And so those are kind of fun things to pick up on as we work our way through.
This makes a lot of sense out of why if you go into a bookstore, there are volumes written on just parsing verbs.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's very complex. There's so many different, parts of it.
There are entire volumes just on how to parse.
Yep.
Because it's...
And then the significance of those different forms. Yeah.
The importance is, cannot be underestimated.
Yep. Absolutely. So anyways, I hope this at least starts helping wrap your mind around it, whet your appetite for learning verbs. But how y'all holding up? I got about 30 minutes here. Need a cup of coffee? Yeah. Oh, you have a heater? What? Oh my goodness. That's awesome. That was awesome. Here, pour a cup of coffee. Yeah, cradle a cup of coffee for a minute and then it cools off, and it's not as cool as a heater, okay, but...
I was talking to someone, and I said, but you know what happens if you get too cold, don't you? You fall asleep and you don't wake up.
It's called hypothermia. Well said. Okay. Okay, so now, just quick interview. So Zoe, how much have you guys talked in your class about verb tenses? And how much of this is new information for you?
I would say we definitely tended towards the traditional view. And so we covered a little bit of aspect, as in like completed or ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
But like the whole, like what's used primarily in narrative versus epistle, that was completely new.
Yeah, that's more advanced second year, even third year stuff sometimes. But the discourse dynamics, to me, is one of the most fun things about Greek, is once you start understanding how it works, and that's largely that Runge book that I recommended to you at, like, I think day one. Runge, R-U-N-G-E. I think it's just called Discourse Dynamics of the Greek New Testament or something like that, Discourse Elements, something like that. His book was very much groundbreaking. It was his doctoral dissertation. And it was very groundbreaking. He's kind of shifted the map a little bit in Greek studies, New Testament Greek studies. And I can't recommend it highly enough. I mean, if you're a nerd and you would read stuff like that, you know, then.
What's the title?
Runge, let me pull it up actually in my, because I have it. Let me just go to, it's thinking. This one right here. So let me pull up the info tab. Maybe. No, it's right here. Yeah, so Discourse Grammar of the Greek New Testament, a practical introduction for teaching an exegesis. Stephen Runge is how you say his name. So for me, this is what made Greek the most beneficial and helpful and fun. Was understanding discourse features and discourse dynamics, which is, again, that's kind of high-level stuff. We haven't got there yet. But you got to learn the grammar stuff, right? You got to kind of learn the nuts and bolts before you can start appreciating, you know, the discourse features. But I'm going to drop information like that as we go, just hopefully to whet your appetite, get you, you know, keep you going, keep you motivated, but to say, hey, Greek does genuinely help. It pays off. It's a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun too. And for me, that was one of the most helpful things, is to see how the author is building a narrative, particularly narrative, but also true in epistles, but particularly narrative. And I started even studying, because it's just Greek. It's the way Greek works. And so it's also a lot of fun when you get to that stage and you're advanced enough to start reading the Old Testament in Greek, start reading the Septuagint, because the Old Testament is a ton of narrative. But the way that they build narrative is really interesting, like what verb tenses they use, you know, what verbs are drawn out as the primary verbs in the sentence, what are backgrounded verbs, what's backgrounded information, what's subordinating, you know, subordinate verbs versus your primary action. And there's just a lot of ways in Greek, you can communicate what is important in the text. And so there's, like, in the discourse grammar, he basically gives you, not that many, maybe 12, 15 different things to look out for. And then he says, whenever you're looking at a text, you look for what he calls the turbulent areas. In other words, multiple discourse features are all in one verse. And that's the dead giveaway, that to the author, that was the most important verse in the paragraph. He's drawing your attention to that. Things like, behold, right? Like, that's an attention getter. He uses, he was going, or he is going. He uses a historic present. He, you know, will bring out a number of different features that you don't know yet, but discourse features that are all piled up in one verse. And it's like he's screaming at you that this is really important, right? And so in Greek, it's kind of helpful because you don't always catch that in English. You're just reading around and you're reading the same paragraph over and over and you're like, what is going on here? But in Greek, it helps point you to what is, in the author's mind, the most important part of his sentence or his paragraph. And so it gives you an insight into what is known as authorial intent. What was the intent of the original author? What was he trying to communicate? And just the way he writes it in Greek gives you a clue into that, what he considers most important. So To me, that's very helpful in exegesis, because then you can, with more confidence, you can say, okay, this is the main point of the paragraph. This is the whole point of the narrative. This is, you know, kind of helpful that way.
So in the Septuagint, that was written in, during the time of Alexander the Great, right? When he grouped everything.
Yeah, just after him.
So the people that translated that, were they fluent Hebrew and fluent Greek?
So,
yes,
but they're not...
How do they know the nuances of the Hebrew language in order to be able to make...
So, that's a good question. It's not all of equal value. So the Septuagint, right, stands for 70. So there's 70 different translators that translate the Old Testament. And so they're translating different parts. And I'm not an expert in the Septuagint, but from what I've been told, by and large, the books of Moses are some of the best of the Septuagint. Like, very well done, good translations. They show a high level of expertise in both languages. But other portions, so some are poorly preserved. So there's portions of, I think it's like 1st, 2nd Samuel that went through a lot of, like there's a lot of problem with the textual transmission. So there's a lot of variants, things like that. But by the time you get to like the minor prophets are less well done. They're more sloppy.
This happens with the minor prophets.
Yeah, right? It is so true. It's like by the time they got to the minor prophets, they were just done. Yeah, right? They were just checking out. No, but it's interesting. It's insightful because it shows you, but it's more of a dynamic translation in some places where they'll actually change the word, but they're interpreting it for you. Mm-hmm. And that's, the Psalms are kind of a spattering. You know, like I gave an example. When we were doing Meditations on Messiah series, and you remember in Hebrews 10, he's quoting Psalm 40 in Hebrews chapter 10. But what's interesting is when he quotes Psalm 40, he's quoting the Septuagint, and he's not quoting the Masoretic. So when you read it in your English Bible, the English is translating the Masoretic text, and it says, "You dug out my ear." Remember that? That's it. That's the Hebrew idiom. In Psalm 40, verse whatever it is, 6 or 8, he says, "You dug out my ear," which is a picture of, you know, it's believed to be, well, there's some debate on that, but most would say it's an allusion to the bond slave deal, right? When your ear is pierced and you're nailed to the door of the house. And the idea is that it's a symbol or an idiom for total allegiance. But the translators of the Septuagint said, "A body you have prepared for me." So they don't even use the Greek word ear. They use the Greek word soma, body, means body. So they broaden it because they're interpreting that idiom in Hebrew and they're using an equivalent idiom in Greek. Because in Greek, you don't say, "You dug out my ear." That makes no sense. But that was a Hebrew idiom. But in Greek culture, they're like, well, that means you've prepared a body for me. Or in other words, they've dedicated their body to total service, right? It's the idea of a bond slave, right? So it's not just the dig your ear, that's a Hebrew idiom. But in Greek equivalent, it's, well, you know, it's you've dedicated your body.
So whoever wrote that understood that idiom very well.
Right. So they changed the idiom, but that's more of a dynamic translation, right? Well, then that really helps Paul, if Paul's the author. But then when he's writing in Hebrews, he quotes that as a messianic text, and he says, "A body you've prepared for me." And he uses that to describe the incarnation, that a body was prepared for Jesus in the incarnation when he becomes human.
So that raises the question, is the Septuagint inspired language then, since it's then quoted in the New Testament?
It's a good question.
Because it does change the idea slightly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, and that's also debated. What I would say is what is quoted is inspired, right? So like if a New Testament author quotes it, he's under inspiration. So that would then be inspired.
His use of it would be
inspired. Yep.
Kind of like when he quotes outside authors.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And so, but it doesn't necessarily canonize or you know, like the entire Septuagint as being perfect or... You know, because that's a big debate in Old Testament studies, is which one do you give greater weight to? Septuagint or the Masoretic text.
Right.
The Masoretic text is normally considered more reliable and something that we should default to that.
Just like the Greek.
Right.
Well, and what the scholars, the 70 scholars involved in the Septuagint, they were scholars in residence at the Library of Alexandria.
They were in Alexandria, Egypt.
And so the amount of scrolls they had available was greater than anywhere on earth at the time, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't it kind of like saying, because the world had become Hellenized. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to make the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, available to a world that's now Hellenized. Mm-hmm. It would kind of be like saying how the NLT is doing that for this generation. They're trying to make the Bible more accessible
to a broader audience.
Yes, yes.
Yep, in a more understandable way. And that's the whole point of the Septuagint, was to put it in the common vernacular. Because at that time, they were all speaking Greek.
Yeah.
And Hebrew was dying out. They didn't know it as well.
Like Old English Now and New Living Translation is just trying to contextualize it more for the generation that's reading it.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. Because, the Septuagint comes along after Alexander the Great, a little over 100 years after Alexander. And what happens is a bunch of the Jews and people interested in reading the Old Testament were now, they were like second, third generation Greek speakers now. And Hebrew was being lost, or they didn't know it as well. So most of them could not read a Hebrew Old Testament. And so that's
more of a scholarly language.
Yeah, yeah. And of course it was resurrected later, but it was to make it more understandable to the masses, then they translate into Greek. But again, it's not all uniform. The level of expertise in the Septuagint varies greatly depending on what book you're in. Yeah.
Where burnout happened,
huh? Yeah, exactly. Where burnout happened. Or they just it was like a committee and hey, you're in charge of translating, Moses, books of Moses, you're in charge of the minor prophets. Well, but that guy's really good and this guy's not as good, right? And so it's like, exactly. And so his work is shoddy compared to the other guy. Yeah, exactly. And so that's reflected in the translation. Yeah. But there's a good book, I haven't read it yet, but it's been recommended to me it's called An Invitation to the Septuagint and the guy's name will come to me. De Silva, I think, is the one who does it. But that's helpful introduction, I've been told. And it kind of gives you a lay of the land on what's the best parts of the Septuagint to study. It's all worth reading because it's actually, it's one of the earliest testaments, texts that we have of the Old Testament. And that's why the Masoretic text was for a long time, because the Septuagint was argued as much older than the Septuagint. Or I'm sorry, the Septuagint than the Masoretic. And it was over 1,000 years older. But then we found the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's actually still debated, but it's believed to be, most of the time, it sides with the Masoretic over the Septuagint. So it vindicated the Masoretic as being good and a strong, been well-preserved. Yeah. So that's where most scholars today will still default and say, okay, learn. If you're really into this, learn Hebrew, study the Masoretic text over and above the Septuagint.
Old Testaments now, current ones, are they relying more on the Masoretic or the Septuagint?
It depends on the edition that you get.
Because the New King James, they used more of the Septuagint, right?
They used kind of a mix, of the Septuagint and Dead Sea Scrolls and, readings. Because basically what happens is what a lot of modern criticism is doing, textual criticism, is you have three primary sources for the Old Testament. You have Masoretic text, Septuagint, Dead Sea Scrolls. But then occasionally you'll have the Samaritan Pentateuch, right? But that's only for the books of Moses, right? Because it's only the Pentateuch. But the Samaritan Pentateuch's another source. And what they do is when you have a disagreement, they basically pick two out of three, right? Two out of the three will typically agree with each other. The Masoretic will agree with the Dead Sea Scrolls against the Septuagint, so they go with that reading. But then there's several times the Dead Sea Scrolls side with the Septuagint against the Masoretic text, so they decide to do with that reading. instead.
Prior to the Dead Sea Scrolls, they had those same ones, just not the Dead Sea Scrolls. Is that kind of the situation, and that they refer more to the Septuagint because it was older?
Yeah, before the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, then we really just had the two primary sources.
They probably would have sided with the older one at that point.
Right. Well, that was the argument, is they were, the Septuagint supporters were saying, hey, Septuagint's 1,000 years older, over 1,000 years older than the Masoretic text. We should trust this more.
So that would have been like the King James, the Geneva would have sided more towards that.
That's a good question, because I need to go double check on that. I think they went with, I'm pretty sure they went with the Masoretic there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. More, over the Septuagint. Yeah.
That would be interesting if they did, because that's before Dead Sea Scrolls.
Mm-hmm. It was well before that.
The newer text.
Yep.
Well, and the, I think there, because a lot, because the translation, the King James was interested in the original language, because like Wycliffe's work was done on the Septuagint.
Yeah, it's a...
Wycliffe's,
yeah,
and
I think he was from the Latin into English.
And then, Tyndale,
yeah,
who went back to the original Greek,
yeah,
but,
and Hebrew. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, and Hebrew.
Yeah,
Hebrew.
And Hebrew. Yeah, and but the Masoretic text.
That's why going to the original language becomes so important, because, I mean, you know, and even, you know, they started revising their own translations before they were even finished, because the more they translated, the better they become at it.
Yeah,
you know,
and whereas, then they go back. And,
whereas
yep.
The King James took a couple hundred years before the first revision came about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep, and there, I mean, and the King James translators, you know, they were pretty expert. Yes. Like, I mean, when you go back, it's like they did a really good job.
Well, and it wasn't just one person.
Right, and it was a committee. Yeah, it was a large committee. I forget the number, but but looking back at their scholarship, it's actually been impressive. Yeah, the King James is, again, it largely, you know, like the big fault of it today is it's out of date with modern English. But like when you look back at the Greek and the Hebrew, like in their day when they translated in their English, you know, like it was very accurate. Yeah.
Thee and thou and ye have fallen out of favor in modern
days. Exactly, exactly, exactly. But that's why I typically say, and I like New King James for that. It just updates the language. Yeah. But it's still holding to all the major translation calls of the King James. And so with rare exception, there's some exceptions. But so I like King James, New King James. And then I really like the ESV a lot. Yeah, as I'm translating through the New Testament, I have been over and over impressed with, and the Old Testament, I'm translating Joshua right now. And there's been several times I'm like, ESV is my favorite translation of that verse.
Stays with the word for word.
Yeah, it's a little more consistent with that.
It's smoother than the NASB.
It is. Yeah.
I
agree.
ESV for personal study.
Yeah, I'm
have the New King James in church because it's easier to follow you.
Right.
King James.
Right.
But,
yep. But the ESV, I've got a lot of respect for the ESV. The biggest difference is the text base is quite a bit different. I mean, it's not quite a bit, but you know, I mean, it's the eclectic text that it uses instead of the majority text, which the King James, New King James is going to have different readings than the ESV. But that's its own issue, is which text do you favor, right? But when it comes to the actual translation, I have a lot of respect for the ESV translation. They're doing a good job, or they did a good job. I don't know what update they're on, but how many revisions they've done, but yeah, those would probably be my top three that I always recommend to folks: King James, New King James, ESV. But, and then to varying degrees, you know, every translation has a strong suit. You know, there's something they're good at, but like NIV is really good in Old Testament poetry.
Well, you know, and it's interesting because I get posed that question a lot. People say, what translation? And I base my decision on a lot of things, like how new of a Christian are they?
Right.
You know, how,
exactly.
How theologically founded are they? You know, because they might not get that. I mean, so sometimes I'll say get the NLT, you know?
Because, absolutely.
Because it would be more accessible to you,
mm-hmm.
and you'll be able to grasp things. And then as you, you know, mature, you can go back and back. But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
No, that's true.
I've been blown away by how many times I've been asked that. What translation should I get?
It comes up a lot.
Yeah. I'm sure you hear it a lot.
Yeah, I hear it a lot. Yep. And I'm with you. It depends on where they're at,
yeah.
You know. And and what they're willing to read. Because the best answer to that question is, you know, when they say, well, what's the best translation? It's the one that you will read, right? I mean, it's like, right? Because it's like, you need to get reading your Bible, right? But
because, you know, for a lot of people, and I've heard this complaint before, is they'll be told by somebody, especially older people, oh, just go with the King James. And then they get fatigued trying to bring the old English into the new language. And then suddenly stop.
They just quit. Yep. What's that? Yeah.
He always said, he's like, I don't
want
to have to translate my Bible and then translate it again.
Right, right.
Well, then my standard answer was, I don't speak old English.
Exactly. That's right. That's where most people... Yeah, that's right. That's where most people are moving away from the King James for that very reason. But I think the one thing I wish more modern translations did was, and the King James, to my knowledge, is the only one that does it, is retaining the difference between singular and plural.
Yeah.
Thee, thou, you, ye, right? Because it's helpful, which you can just do, you know, if you're reading a different translation, just quick glance at the Greek or something and you can figure it out. But in English, as far as I know, King James is the only one that still does that. So, which is helpful.
Well, there's something helpful. You said about the poetry, too. I mean, what's the best version to read the 23rd Psalms in? The King James.
Yep.
It's the most beautiful. It's like I wouldn't want to read Hamlet in New English.
Right. It just doesn't fit. No.
Lost all
that,
you know?
Well said, well said. Yeah, I mean, and every translation has its strengths, you know, and its weaknesses. But and the New King James I really like for its footnotes, like its textual stuff. I think they've got the best footnote system, and I like their cross referencing system as well. But yeah,
what you'd have to do is like the Legacy Standard is the one I've been reading a lot lately, and
I need to spend more time with that one. I haven't spent much time with it, but
puts an asterisk by the. Like some of the verb stuff we were just talking about, where it's worded as a past tense, but it puts the asterisk by it to say, hey, this is actually in the present tense.
Oh, cool. Some of the verses we looked at, they footnoted it. I like to hear that.
So, but which, all you have to do with like the you, if it's plural or not, like just have that at the beginning, your key, whatever, in the beginning Bible translation, be like, hey, we're going to put this symbol by.
Yep.
You every time it's a plural rather than singular.
Right. But most of the time you're not going to find that in a translation. Right. You have to go to a commentary or go to the Greek to see if it's singular or plural. Yeah. And sometimes it's kind of cool. Like one of the ones that's conspicuous is when Jesus addresses Peter. So remember when Peter says, I'll never deny you. And then Jesus says, Satan has requested you that he may sift you as wheat. The you is actually plural. And then he says, but I have prayed for you, Peter, singular. Yep. In the same verse. It's a plural versus singular. Exactly. Exactly. They're all about to undergo a test. But Peter, Jesus is specifically calling out Peter for prayer because Peter's going to get hit hard. Exactly. Because they're all going to scatter, but Peter's going to do the denying, right? And so he's getting extra prayer by Jesus. But most, you're never going to see that in English translation. I mean, unless I think King James again brings it out with the ye, you know, plural in the singular. But that's a cool subtlety that you're not going to catch unless you're in a commentary or in the Greek. Or, again, if you can handle the King James. But even there, most people don't notice that, you know, unless you're really tuned in to the singular versus plural in the text. But there's several places like that that are kind of cool. You're like, oh, that actually does color the way I read this text. Right, and it's kind of helpful, but yeah, they're good. I didn't know that about the Legacy, but I need to spend more time with the Legacy. But they're basically like the update on the NASB, like they're basically taking the NASB as their foundation and kind of trying to polish it and update it and fix what Master's Seminary thinks is weak about the NASB, right? But I need to spend more time with the Legacy because I've heard good things about it. I just haven't spent much time with it, so. But any other thoughts, questions, comments? We're about out of time. But
we've been talking about translations for about 30 minutes.
Well, a lot more than translations. We were talking about textual criticism. Yeah. We were talking about the Greek Septuagint. We kind of did get off on a little rabbit trail there for a while. Okay, but so next time, so we didn't get that far, but. next time we're going to come back and then we're just going to start working through this chart, which is the indicative verb chart. All right. So we're just going to start seeing how to build. So kind of back to that, where we'll start with the root, learned how to build the verbs from the root up, and then by in reverse, you just deconstruct the verb to figure out the form. So we'll start tackling that next week. And yeah, we're just still on the cusp. We're right on the edge of jumping into verbs. There's a lot to learn, okay? But, all right. Any other thoughts before we close? Okay, great. You want to close this prayer, my friend?
Lord, we just thank you once again for this time to try to be learning Greek and just learning how to better study your word and slow down and really think about what you have spoken to us. Lord, I thank you that you do preserve your word and you have promised to preserve it for us, and that we can know you better. And we just pray you give us safety as we travel home. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
Amen.